The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism, this clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast. I haven't recorded an episode for War Notes since April, so it's been over 2 months since I recorded this. This is an alternate podcast, a companion podcast to Chasing Ghost and a regular warfare podcast, in which I wanted to use it to expand my portfolio of the CG agenda beyond irregular warfare and talk about conventional warfare, maybe even its notions of meeting irregular warfare, hybrid warfare, gray zone warfare, and those kind of things. The title of today's episode, which is number 18, is American Military Stalemate and Defeat, a Sterling Record. We're going to discuss why it appears that America's record militarily since the end of World War II has been rather sad and not a an homage to the effectiveness, efficiency, nor the efficacy of how America has fought its wars since the end of World War II in 1945. A little bit of housekeeping. I am currently working on a course that I'll be presenting at the Scott Horton Academy once it gets released into the wild and becomes a real deal. It is a spinoff from the Scott Horton's Libertarian Institute, at which I am a fellow, and now I will be an academic fellow in his virtual university. And I will most likely specialize in, of course, military conflict and historical topics. On a personal note, I did want to make mention, and I think that I said this on the Chasing Ghost podcast, in case there are some listeners who confine themselves exclusively to my War Notes podcast. My eighth grandchild is on the way, hoping to meet that new grandchild next year in the spring. Really excited about that. So my children are doing their duty, as it were, to make sure that we can populate the earth with folks who are going to be home-educated, homegrown, and have a natural skepticism for what the government serves them or attempts to do. So why am I doing this? Well, the reason that I'm doing this is that there seems to be a fiction, a fabulism, misdirection, legerdemain, magical thinking when it comes to the U.S. military, much like what we would find with the Israelis, where the Israeli Defense Force, for instance, is held up as this unique and especially lethal and effective fighting force, which it hasn't been since its first debacles in Lebanon in 1982, and then fast-forwarding to this time period now for a variety of reasons. During this conversation concerning the historical epic from 1945 to present day, in which I will try to give you a very brief snapshot history of warfare that has been made by the United States in some intersectionality, that has certainly been wars in the Middle East, which have not fared well at all, and we'll discuss that. So what I'd like to do is do a thumbnail snapshot of a number of conflicts that America has been involved in since 1945, and then we'll also discuss what are some of the historical dynamics in the decades between that time and this that have caused this evolution to occur, or should we say devolution to occur. Let's set things in turn historically. What we discover is that when you examine U.S. extra-contiguous military campaigns, that meaning those campaigns across the Atlantic or Pacific Ocean, or even past the southern border into other regions, really didn't start in earnest until about 1871, when there was an abortive enterprise to land on the Korean Peninsula and exert either colonial ambitions or assist allies on that same peninsula. That didn't work out at all. I think that there were many presidents after the second American Revolution, which was the U.S. Civil War from 1860 to 1865, once that particular unpleasantness had been resolved, thought, well, let's join that colonial club that the Europeans have been engaged in since going on probably 300 to 400 years in earnest prior to the 19th century, far-flung. Whether it's the British Indian project, the various European projects in Africa, the Portuguese and British projects in Asia, and all of those, America seemed to have a hankering to become an imperial nation, to become a nation of empire. Even to this day, many Americans reflect and they say, well, America can't possibly be an empire because, well, we are the bright, shining beacon on the hill of liberty and freedom and such. Well, I think that if you have come to that conclusion, you've spent much too much time in either government school or watching television. There's a reason why they call it programming. Now, the Hawaiian Kingdom was overthrown in a coup d'etat against Queen Liliuokalani that took place on January 17th, 1893, on the island of Oahu. The coup was led by the Committee of Safety, composed of 7 foreign residents, 5 Americans, 1 Scotsman, and 1 German, and 6 Hawaiian Kingdom subjects of American descent in Honolulu. They prevailed upon the United States to call in the U.S. Marines. The 1993 Apology Resolution by the U.S. Congress concedes that the overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii occurred with the active participation of agents and citizens of the United States, and it goes on, but nonetheless, the dynasty that was created from that point forward established in everything but name only that Hawaii would belong not only as a dependency, but a regional satrap state of the United States within the constraints of whatever the U.S. thought was good for all the Hawaiian islands. Now, if we fast forward 5 years, we find 1898 finds America at war with the Spanish. They're at war with the Spanish in the Atlantic and the Pacific. The Pacific, they're at war with them in the Philippines. And I've described in other podcasts just how loathsome and just morally awful that war was as conducted by American soldiery. Same thing occurs in Cuba, Puerto Rico, and other possessions of which the United States takes charge and adds it onto its jeweled crown of imperial holdings. Now, there are questions here, and some may say, well, why did it take America so long to join the colonial club, even though many American narrative historians would not enjoin this and say, oh, certainly, that wasn't an American empire. They were doing it for their own good. Well, ask the indigenous peoples of those respective countries whether they thought it was for their own good or benefit or not, much less the political collaborators within each of those nation states who found a very comfortable satrap relationship with the United States. My explanation for America being so late to the colonial club is that they were busy now, arguably until 1924, when the last Apache uprising was put down, they were busy with putting down the aboriginal influences and peoples and tribes that were scattered across the North American continent, to include Alaska, in which it took a considerable amount of time, even after the War of Northern Aggression concluded in 1865, for the American federal government and its troops and its fort systems and such to put down aboriginal Indian rebellions across the United States. So I think since America invested so much time and martial effort into besting and putting down the aboriginal originals that were here in North America at the time, they didn't have time to look left, right, or out across the Pacific or the Atlantic and decide, stroking their chins, maybe what we need to do is join that exclusive European club and get some of that filthy lucre and land. So that is my explanation for why it took so long for the Americans to join the European Colonial Club, which had been going on for hundreds of years. Now we fast forward to 1914 to 1918 with World War I, where Woodrow Wilson, arguably one of the worst presidents to ever step foot in the Oval Office, promises on the campaign trail and during the election that he will not get America involved in a foreign war. Well, it turns out, in 1917 and 1918, America does get involved in that war. There are folks out there, like my colleague, Prof. CJ, at the Dangerous History Podcast, and I would urge you to run, not walk, to listen to his extraordinary podcast series on Woodrow Wilson, who is probably one of the original fiends in the American political constellation as far as laying America low and not being a project in pursuit of liberty and freedom, but aggrandizement of power around the world. And what happens with all empires is that everything an empire does abroad, it does at home. He advances the suggestion, and I happen to agree with it, that Woodrow Wilson is patient zero for World War II, because if it weren't for Woodrow Wilson and the entry of America into World War I, the Versailles Treaty probably wouldn't have been approved. The League of Nations probably would not have survived trying to be strangled in the cradle. And Adolf Hitler probably would not have resonated with the people after what was laid upon the German nation after the conclusion of World War I. And then, of course, we can go to World War II, in which America engages in a number of very provocative actions with the Japanese 18 months prior to December 7th, 1941. The Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Within 3 days, the Japanese not only managed to bomb Pearl Harbor and not hit a single carrier, because they all just so happened to be out on deployment, and hits almost exclusively capital ships that were built in World War I, but the Philippines falls, MacArthur, all of it, the Philippines falls, the service that is there is both the Army and the Navy. It is a far Asian fleet under the United States flag that is there. And between December 1941 and April 1942, the Japanese, in exercising their centrifugal strategy, manage to wrest and best territories and militaries from the French, the Dutch, the British, and the U.S. in a centrifugal strategic campaign. That is extraordinary what it achieves in Southeast Asia at the time, but the Japanese days are numbered. There are a number of apocryphal stories where Yamamoto claims that we have awakened a sleeping giant. Is that attributed to reality or not? I don't know, but it is very descriptive of exactly what happened, because in the 4 years after the attack on Pearl Harbor, James Hornfisher, in his extraordinary trio of books where he talks about this, ends with his book Flood Tide and says that America, in a mere 4 years, had erected a seaborne civilization across the Pacific, all the way from the California and West Coast of America to the Japanese homeland, to best them, conquer them, and bring them to the negotiating table on that battleship in August of 1945, coincident with two atom bombs that are detonated on the Japanese mainland. It is not within the scope of this particular episode for us to examine this, but I would urge all of you, if you get the opportunity, to take a look at the fact that the Japanese, since January 1945, had been sending secret and secondary negotiating channel protestations and talk and chatter about negotiating not an unconditional surrender, but a conditional surrender that allowed them to keep their emperor, which, by the way, is what it ended up being. It is my thought that Truman, who knew about the atom bombs after Joseph Stalin did, because of the Soviet-penetrated Swiss cheese that was the Roosevelt awful office at the time, he probably deployed those atomic weapons as a demonstration project to the USSR, who he suspected would be the main player against the United States in the post-World War II world. That was evident to anybody with eyes and who had been paying attention to recent history and what was going on. And probably a demonstration project to say that, yea and verily, we have this ability to keep you at bay. So that brings us to 1945. And it brings us to what is essentially almost a sterling and flawless record of stalemate and defeat. What is the difference between stalemate and defeat? Defeat is where one knows rather well that militarily you have been defeated as a country or an alliance of countries. A stalemate is the frozen peace that one would find, for instance, in Korea and such. So here's what happens after World War II. There is a vast decolonization project across Europe. This doesn't happen to affect the United States because the United States stands as the hyperpower at the time until the Soviet Union in this Cold War effectively starts to dominate its own spheres of influence, not only through foreign espionage, but also because it has not only the atomic bomb, but the hydrogen bomb. And it has the ability to send those aloft with ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and intermediate range ballistic missiles, IRBMs, to threaten the United States. Truman appears to be, unlike his predecessor, a dedicated anti-communist. Hence, succor, materiel, and training is provided to the Greeks to conquer their communist insurgency, and they actually manage to do so, surprisingly enough, in 1947, 48, and 49. Now we fast forward to 1950, and then we find that on the Korean Peninsula, the North Koreans take on the South Koreans, and they manage in a matter of months to take the U.S. and the U.N. forces and the allies who have come to assist the ROK, the Republic of Korea Army, the South Korean Army, into this tiny peninsular squeeze on the southeastern portion, almost pushed into the sea. But thanks to the successful and relatively easy, lightly contested beach landing in Incheon on the western coast in September 1950, all of that persevering by the North Koreans shatters. And the relief is in place, and they start to expand from that lodgment where they were almost pushed into the sea. And then we fast forward to 1953, and it appears that we now have a stalemate, a frozen peace, which has been in place ever since that time. The North Koreans, by the way, are a nuclear power in this small single-digit club on Earth's surface where they actually have nuclear weapons, possibly numbering 30 to 50, possibly numbering on rocket forces and missile modalities that allow them to toss these nuclear weapons against other countries, whether it's Japan or the United States, with circular errors of probability that are numbering in the hundreds of meters. What that means, that CEP, circular error of probability, is the nuclear weapon, once it is launched, it is able to land after traveling hundreds or thousands of miles within an accuracy of 100 meters of where it was originally lofted from when it left its erector launcher. But America was in a terrible way against its Korean foe from 1950 to 53. We've all heard of Task Force Smith, where the initial attempts, much like Kazarine Pass in 1942 in Africa, where American first fights didn't fare very well at all. Same thing occurred here. And eventually, they were able to wrest control of South Korea for the most part, return it to its original borders, for the most part, but by the skin of their teeth. And remember, 5 years prior, in August 1945, America had stood astride the planet as a military colossus. But in the five-year period of time between 1945 and 1950, there had been considerable demobilization, loss of a lot of that military power with enlisted men, NCOs, and officers going away into civilian life and pursuing other things. The fabbing capability that was unmatched around the world industrially was nowhere to be found. But again, it's 1953. America comes home. It does leave a force there, which still remains there in 2nd ID, 2nd Infantry Division, as a token trigger force to be tripped over by the North Koreans if they ever were to invade again, so that the Americans' hand would be forced to come back to their ROC, their Republic of South Korea allies, and protect them and wage war with North Korea at the time. Fortunately, knock on wood, that hasn't happened since that frozen peace occurred in 1953. And then a lot of curious things start to come with the European colonial projects because they start shattering like cheap balsa wood on impact. By 1948, the British Empire is nothing but rocks. Pitcairn Island, the Falkland Islands, a number of smaller holdings, nothing but rocks. They lose the Raj, their Indian jewel in the crown by this time. And the sun has set on the British Empire that stood astride the planet for over 200 years. Same thing happens with the French. The French managed during this period of time in the 1950s, where it's 1954 at a place called Dien Bien Phu, where French paratroopers are in a valley surrounded on mountaintops by the very sophisticated conventional and irregular warfare elements conjoined seamlessly of the North Vietnamese Communist Party, and they are driven out of Vietnam by 1958 to 62. After a four-year interregnum after 1958, the French find their vast holding due south of France, even recognized as a part of metropolitan France since the 1830s with the Pétainois French colonials, shoved out of Algeria entirely. Algeria also becomes an adjacent communist nation to the south of France. And North Vietnam finds that the pressure that they are able to exert on South Vietnam, which remains non-communist for a period of time as such, that it almost presages America's evolving involvement in that conflict, which Eisenhower avoided, but Kennedy sort of suckered himself into once he came into office in 1961, after the 1960 election of JFK. And the dominoes start to fall according to the intelligentsia, which within the U.S. Defense Department and the Pentagon and the DOD. And so Vietnam sucker punches the U.S. intelligentsia and the Pentagon generals and admirals into saying, yay and verily, 1965 and 66, we will rev up our commitment to South Vietnam. Now, during this time, Vietnam is not the only concern, because I skipped over rather quickly what happens in the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, where JFK and the Soviets play nuclear chicken. Fortunately, cooler heads prevailed, and everybody said, well, we'll agree if the Soviets will remove said missiles from Cuba. And the Jupiter missiles weren't removed as a form of reciprocity from Turkey. And that was sort of like a burr in the saddle in U.S.-Soviet relationships from that point forward. In the Dominican Republic, which happens to be on the island of Hispaniola, with Haiti in the west and the Dominican Republic in the east, there is a civil war that takes place over there between communist and non-communist forces. The U.S. intervenes with literally thousands of Marine troops. That particular argument is settled in 65 and 66, and then the major proponency for all U.S. military efforts continues in Vietnam with bombing campaigns, the expansion of the Vietnamese War into Laos and Cambodia, respectively, to try to stymie the flow of arms and personnel and materiel down the Ho Chi Minh Trail with defoliation, invasions of those adjacent countries, mass bombing of the North, and all of these things. But all of that comes to a halt in 1972 with Nixon's election, where he takes it upon himself as a campaign promise, and it appears to be a promise that he indeed keeps, to get America out of the Vietnam War. This results in draft riots starting to winnow and be held at bay, especially in 1972, after the draft is eliminated. Effectively, in 1972, there is a large drawdown, which will give memory hints to everybody here who has been watching what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. And what it will do is cause America to say, we're going to reduce our forces significantly until 1975, when all U.S. forces depart Vietnam and South Vietnam is absorbed by North Vietnam into Communist Vietnam. But surprisingly enough, the Communist Vietnamese coalesce themselves and get involved not only in a number of fights with the Chinese, which they win hands down, because the Vietnamese have a very curious history in which not many countries that have contiguously or extra contiguously invaded them have succeeded in occupying Vietnam and being successful. Now, as a result of the Laotian and Cambodian intrigues that were visited upon those countries by American invasions from 1965 to 1975, Pol Pot, the communist eliminator, as it were, takes over. I don't know whether he holds a world record for per capita death camps and deaths by the government itself, hat tip to R.J. Rummel. But I do think that he wins several awards for the number per capita of folks that he does manage to eliminate and murder in the killing fields of communist Kampuchea. Now, this leads to Desert One, 1979-1980. Jimmy Carter has succeeded Gerald Ford after Nixon left the office in disgrace. He wins the election, a malaise sets in to the U.S. economy, but in 1979, the 1953 coup in Iran has run its course. The CIA, of course, was involved in that, as they have been involved in so many of these wars of aggression and coups and color revolutions around the planet that have, over the last 70 years, really set into a place a lot of the conflict complexes, regional conflict complexes, and wars, especially in the Middle East and especially in Africa, that have caused so many problems for Europeans and Americans alike. This is the first performance of the embryonic and legendary Delta Force. Delta Force, Charlie Beckwith, spends a considerable amount of time with the SAS as an exchange officer. He brings back British Special Air Service selection standards to what would become the premier hostage rescue unit and counterterrorism unit in the United States military, which was then known as Delta, which is now known as CAG, the Combined Arms Group. Who knows what other permutations that rather quiet and stealthy group of professionals will call themselves. But nonetheless, Desert One is a debacle. It is a debacle of interoperability, a debacle of communications, and a debacle of timing. Marines, U.S. Air Force, U.S. Navy, Army personnel who have not done sufficient rehearsals for getting themselves into the desert with aircraft, both rotary wing and fixed wing, and done it in a fashion in which they couldn't not collide with one another. It appears that one of the Marine helicopters collided with one of the U.S. Air Force or Navy fixed-wing aircraft. You can read all about this and dig into it. There's plenty on the net or books available that you can find that give all the gory details of the debacle that happened in the desert in Iran at that time. They were not able to make it into Tehran and rescue the hostages. The hostages did manage to come back as a result of negotiations, but it wasn't through military force and the hostage taking. So Delta and all of its confreres come back with their tail between their legs after being defeated. Now we can fast forward to the 1982-1984 Lebanese conflict in which the IDF invades, the Israelis invade Lebanon. There is a peace enforcement operation that takes place to keep the Israelis and the Druze and all of the other competing parties in Lebanon away from each other so that they could settle into a frozen peace of sorts that has eerie reminiscence of what happened in Korea. In October 23rd, 1983, two truck bombs are detonated on buildings in Beirut that just so happened to be housing the American and French service members of the multinational force in Lebanon. 241 U.S. dead and 58 French military personnel, 6 civilians, and 2 attackers. Again, tail between the legs. All military forces are withdrawn from Lebanon. It just so happens that coincident to this time, in October 1983, there is the invasion of Grenada in Operation Urgent Fury to free the 600-odd medical students who are trapped on that country and sending up signal flares that the communist coup that occurs in Grenada must be stopped. Marine forces, naval forces, army forces, to include 75th Ranger Parachute and 82nd Airborne Parachute operations are conducted to seize airfields so that follow-on forces in air landings by the 82nd especially come on the ground. And that is not necessarily defeat, but what were they fighting? It wasn't much of a fight on the ground. They were fighting Cubans and they were fighting maybe some Russian forces by the handful, but for the most part, they were Russian and Cuban trained Grenadian armed forces, which were third rate at best. Now, I happen to think, and you may have heard me discuss this in my Chasing Ghosts podcast, that between the Cubans and the East Germans in the Warsaw Pact, as it were, I'm not even certain that the Cubans could be referred to as a Warsaw Pact, but we're going to call them Soviet allies nonetheless, were probably two of the most talented non-Soviet forces out there who could put up a fight and do it very well. Now, it is prospective for the East Germans, but we all know that if the East Germans had any residuals of the Wehrmacht's capabilities during World War II, they were probably very good at what they did. I'm always amused by someone who had said, you know, if the East Germans can't get communism right, nobody can. Well, the Cubans just so happened to be folks who could fight above their weight again and again. We saw a hint of it here, but there simply weren't enough on the ground. But when one looks at what happened from 1984 to 1988 on the African continent around Angola, the Cubans gave better than they could. They made a very good fighting force, very effective, to include those forces they were training. And they even gave the very well-honed and effective South African fighting forces a run for their money in Angola. Then, of course, we have the Libya bombing, where Gaddafi is put on notice that it is time for you to stop pursuing your chemical, biological, and possibly nuclear weapons programs, because America will look askance at you having that capability. So there was a bombing campaign that occurred 15 April 1986. This may have been the last F-111F bombing campaign conducted by that particular airframe, which is a redoubtable airframe and probably one of the better ones that were produced in the 1960s and 70s. Now, it just so happens in the same year, there's something called the Goldwater-Nichols Act. The Goldwater-Nichols Act is widely praised for improving military organization and joint operations. Some argue it has unintended negative consequences. I'm one of those. Critics point to a weakened role for service chiefs, prioritizing combatant commanders' regional focus over broader strategic threats, and a potentially inflexible defense bureaucracy. I happen to think the Goldwater-Nichols Act was a disaster for a variety of reasons, because it did give us combatant commanders and theater commanders. You would have Northern Command with the U.S. You would have Southern Command with South America. You would have these commands festooned around the globe, excepting Antarctica, in which you would have general officers who would serve as military governors without portfolio, who would have extraordinary powers within their respective kingdoms, as it were. And they were the ones who would fight among each other in Machiavellian knife fights and bureaucratic whispers and intrigue to see who could get the most money from the very limited pie that was available to the United States. Despite the fact that we're spending almost $1 trillion a year, we certainly weren't spending $1 trillion a year then. But of course, we've always had a finite pie. When you have a finite pie of monies available and you put people in power with this kind of bureaucratic power, you are always going to have rice bowl and food fights that are going to take place. And I do think that one notices, whether coincident or correlative or causative, you find that this strategic deficit disorder that has haunted the Pentagon since, I would argue, the fall of the wall in 1991, you have this kind of bureaucratic behemoth, this monster of labyrinthine bureaucracy and acquisition dysfunction that is something to behold. From this, we even get SOCOM, the Special Operations Command, which didn't exist prior to this time, which gels together and consolidates all of these special operations forces, whether it's the Air Force Special Tactics Squadrons, pararescuemen, and close combat controllers, or the U.S. Army Special Forces, or the U.S. Army Rangers, or it could be the Navy SEALs, or it could be MARSOC, which would raise its ugly head from the Marine Corps so that they could join this exclusive club. I didn't mention Delta or CAG because it just so happens that in SOCOM they create something called the Joint Special Operations Command, which has a very tenuous relationship within SOCOM as its own umbrella entity that can pretty much do what it wishes. And of course, that caused a lot of friction and problems within SOCOM. And again and again, one sees that it didn't make things better. From 1989 to 1991, all of a sudden, the Soviet Union, which had stood as a communist colossus astride the planet also since 1918 to 1921, collapses. And all the Stan brothers on the underbelly of the Soviet Union fall away from the Soviet Union proper. Russia, Belarus, the Ukraine, and other entities within Russia proper remain in the Russian Federation, but a lot of those Muslim countries that were on the underbelly fall away. It is also at this time that 3 years prior, the Soviet engagement and what would become the Russian disaster in Afghanistan had been concluded. And again, after defeating the English twice, the Afghans managed to defeat the Russians once, and it was yet to be determined what would happen once America came in. But we have the Monday morning quarterbacking to know that it would not fare well. Kuwait is invaded by Iraq, the fifth largest army on planet Earth, in 1990. This is Project 17, begins on 2 August 1990, and this marked the beginning of the Gulf War. They defeated the country of Kuwait on 4 August and started to militarily occupy the country of Kuwait for 7 months. This got the attention of the United States and findings, and it is not within the scope of this to argue whether Ms. Glaspie did give permission for this federal employee, Saddam Hussein, because after all, he had been heavily supported by the U.S. in the Iran-Iraq War, which killed hundreds of thousands and injured millions of Iranians and Iraqis during the 1980s in the conduct of that particular conflict. Nonetheless, the newly fabbed, flagged, and jointly operated United States Army finds itself bested in Kuwait and pretty much annihilated for everything that stayed in place from the 24th to the 28th of February 1991 in the 100-hour war that would occur. And as a result of Colin Powell insisting that clear delineated guidelines for what success looked like determined that once Kuwait was secured, that there would be no further movement into Iraq to consolidate this win and bring it home to Baghdad to put Iraq down militarily. Now, I happen to think that it was a wise move to do that at the time. But nonetheless, the title of this particular episode is Stalemate and Defeat. And many of my listeners will say, well, wow, it was a resounding success at this time against Iraq and Kuwait. Well, it turns out, as we all know, that America would be revisiting Iraq in just a dozen years to take out Saddam Hussein and take out that country's Sunni leadership, Sunni minority in this case, in something that was completely unrelated to 9/11, but just so happened to be a war of convenience because of 21 causes belli that were created to say, yea and verily, we must invade because of notions of yellow cake, uranium production, unfair treatment of its own citizens, the smashing of the Shia and the Kurds and such, and whatever other excuses were made to invade this and yet another U.S. war of choice and yet another war in which Colin Powell played a signature part. Between 1991 and 2003, there would be a devastating to the Iraqis air exclusion zone that would be commanded by the United States and its allies, and sanctions imposed upon the country to try to wrest Saddam Hussein's power from his hands, not through military might, but through economic blockade. That failed for a number of reasons. And then we have, in 2001, on September 11th, and here we are in the 21st century, we have the attack on the towers in New York, the attack on the Pentagon, the stymied attack on what could have been the White House or the congressional complex by Al-Qaeda operatives who were operating out of both Pakistan and Afghanistan. In this case, it turns out that America, under George W. Bush, elects to go into Afghanistan militarily in October and November of 2001, which is presaging the 2003 invasion of Iraq, which would be done a mere 2 years after that. And at first, there is success, but the bogging down starts and the extension of the nation building and the huge contractor bonanza, the U.S. aid funding, the State Department funding, all of the spigots are opened wide to feed into this whatever activities the U.S. government and its allies could cobble together for nation building in both Afghanistan and 2 years later, Iraq. And then we discover that Obama comes in office in 2008 and 2009 with promises that he would restrict American operations in Afghanistan and Iraq and try to get America out of that briar patch. Well, it turns out that the Obama administration not only conducts the war in Iraq and Afghanistan in an expanded fashion, but he opens up war fronts in Syria, in Yemen, in Libya, and in the Horn of Africa. These all belong to his presidency. As far as more wars of choice that are embarked upon by the United States and its allies. Ironically, when we fast forward to today, what we discover is that Syria is now a wholly owned subsidiary of Al-Qaeda. Now, Al-Qaeda and the U.S. are not strange bedfellows. They've been in bed together since the 1980s. I'd mentioned the CIA and other three-letter agencies through their covert actions and activities, one could say going all the way back to its founding in 47, 48, and 49, have been engaged in these kind of black clandestine and covert operations and color revolutions and all kinds of chicanery and things that they were doing planet-wide to influence those nations' effects on the national security of the United States in their own vision of what that should look like. Syria is now run by Al-Qaeda. And of course, in between all of this, between the beginning of the 21st century with September 11th and now, there have been a number of other issues which have been making themselves evident and obtaining, such as the stranglehold that the Yemenis happen to have, especially the Houthis in the western part of that nation, the most mountainous part of that nation, supported by Iran, supported by BRICS nations most likely, like China and Russia through technology cutouts and things like that. So when we take a gander backwards in the rearview mirror and we look at America's military adventures since that time, I would say that this sterling record of stalemate and defeat obtains. After all, it's the Taliban that was in power in the 1990s. They are in power again in Afghanistan. Whatever administration you wish to blame for that, I don't think you can blame a single one. I think it was a composite of all of them who were involved in this debacle. But the Taliban defeated four presidents, and they have Afghanistan back. When Saddam Hussein, as odious and murderous a character as he was in charge of Iraq, nonetheless, he had contained in that genie's bottle all the Kurd, Sunni, Shia, and other factional strife that had been within that country for the longest time. One finds consistently that when it comes to regional conflict complexes that experience these larger wars overweening their borders, that as I have mentioned before, it breathes oxygen into the forever embers of factional clan and blood disputes in the Middle East and brings new life to them in a fashion that tends to be a second and third order effect. One in the West would say it's an unintended consequence, but it's an intended consequence if these wars of choice are waged and just so happen to breathe oxygen into the embers of all of these. As I mentioned, between World War II and this time, that bright shining time in February 1991, when in that 100-hour war, American military brilliance was on display for the entire planet to behold, and here, after the Soviets had been laid low and the Warsaw Pact had shattered and the Russian military had shattered, 1991, America steps forward as the preeminent and hyperpower of planet Earth in 1991. But now we fast forward almost a half century in this year of our Lord 2025, and when I reflect on American military power, here's what I see. I see this massive, incredibly wealthy and well-endowed military complex in the Pentagon and all of its associated tentacles in the Department of Energy and all the other departments, and its capture in the congressional industrial military complex that President Eisenhower warned us about. And they have a lot of trouble producing things that are fit for 21st century peer combat. I always characterize America's present day military forces across the board, less the U.S. nuclear submarine forces, which is a discussion that I've had in past episodes, but no one on Earth can come close to the kind of nuclear arsenal that is available in a stealthy fashion from U.S. submarines, nuclear submarines in this case, with their submarine-launched ballistic missiles and such. No one comes close to that capability, but it is the one unique and boutique military capability that the United States has that nobody else does, because everything else is behind the times. If I were to characterize the United States military, I would say that it is the most exquisite, expensive, and well-formed 20th century military formation, absolutely not fit for purpose for 21st century peer combat. Folks aren't going to like what I'm about to say, especially those of you who are possessed by what Peter Boghossian characterizes as side bias, which is the hardest bias to defeat. But since the special military operation by the Russians was launched against the Ukraine, it appears, if one is paying attention with eyes wide open and not eyes wide shut to things that you don't want to hear or listen to, that the most lethal land force on planet Earth happens to be the Russians and not the Americans. And the Russians are fighting on their own doorstep, and any military or NATO threat to Russia, I think, is obviated by the nuclear forces that Russia still commands. And there's no doubt that America commands significant nuclear forces, despite the drawdown of a peak of 50,000 nuclear munitions planet-wide since the 1980s, down to less than 10,000 among the countries of the United States, Russia, Pakistan, India, China, North Korea, France, and Britain. It appears that the South Africans, in history since World War II, have been the only nuclear power that detonated nuclear munitions in 1977 over the Atlantic, are the only first world country, arguably, that has surrendered that nuclear capability. In my mind, the Russians are chess players. The West, in both the U.S. and NATO, happen to be checkers players, unfortunately. They are always stymied and defeated by these moves by greater industrial powers, despite the fact that they don't have the wealth of the West and what they are able to do in a pinch and how they're able to conjoin hybrid warfare, gray zone warfare, unconventional warfare, irregular warfare with conventional warfare. One can say, for instance, and I have talked about this in episode 48 in Chasing Ghosts, where I talked about the peer strike ISR complex, the need for rational fires coordination, and I describe in detail how the Russians have pretty much broken the code on that kind of thing. And I've also done a number of podcast episodes over there where I discuss some of the things that I've talked about here today, to include drone warfare, the problem sets, the wicked problem sets of fighting in mountainous terrain, sabotage, and also my notion in episode 54 of Chasing Ghosts, which was broadcast last year, the American military empire is in terminal collapse. I still agree with that, even though we're 8 months from that particular prognostication. I don't like that. I was a serving officer and a former NCO, I'm a Mustang, in the American Armed Forces for the longest time. Proud of my service, not proud of some of the things that I did, But nonetheless, with a heavy heart, I say that the United States is in terminal decline when it comes to the military-industrial complex. If, for instance, December 7th were to replicate itself tomorrow morning and somehow, some way, that same kind of calamity befell America, we don't have the hard-bitten population from the Great Depression of hard men that would populate the American military to the tune of 12 to 14 million men in uniform. We don't have the fabbing. We don't have the manufacturing. We don't have the closeness to people working with their hands and being able to build these miracle weapons, wonder weapons, and weapons in such numerous quantity that they pale, that all other nations combined paled in comparison to being able to achieve that. I mean, if you look at the sheer number of weapons that were given through lend-lease to the UK and the Soviet Union and other odious allies during World War II, nothing could match that today. We only have two shipyards that are capable of building nuclear hulls for the U.S. Navy. The U.S. Navy, since its successful commissioning of the Arleigh Burke in 1991, has failed to put a single hull in the water that has been successful. The Zumwalt destroyer is just a disaster. The little crappy ship, the littoral combat ships, have been a disaster. Some of them are being retired 5 years into their 30-year shelf life. We have the USS Ford, which has still not taken an operational capability in hand that allows it to reliably launch and retrieve aircraft. You have only one job. And it goes on and on. The Air Force suffers the same. They doubled the shelf life of the last B-52 to leave the factory, which was in 1962, because the B-1B, the B-2, which numbers at 20, and other aircraft simply can't be produced in the numbers that the B-52 was created. We are going to have a B-52 whose shelf life is doubled, and at 100 years, that is going to possibly have in its cockpit the grandsons or great-grandsons of former pilots in the same airframe. I would suggest that the era of the manned tank is over. The era of the infantry fighting vehicle is over. The era of the infantryman on the ground being relatively safe is over. No one could have told me in 2020 that by 2025, 80% of all the combat casualties in the country of Ukraine after the Russian invasion would be due to FPVs and UAVs. So what I wanted to get across in this episode was to go over a rather detailed yet thumbnail history of American stalemate and defeat since the end of World War II. And by the way, World War II could not have been won without the Russians. Something has to be done, and it's not being done. I often think that in the 1960s, when the present acquisition system that burdens the United States military-industrial complex may have been developed by the Soviets, where they said, my gosh, we can't possibly defeat the Americans, but what if we gave them a communist-style acquisition system? And that's what we're burdened with today. When you look at successful hulls for the Navy, successful aircraft, successful tanks and such, it's almost impossible. The Minuteman III just so happens to be the third leg in the triad for the nuclear deterrent that America possesses, and they want to replace it with something called the Sentinel. And it keeps moving to the right, it keeps increasing in cost, and one has to ask oneself, where are the successes when it comes to materiel and logistics and weapon systems? Now, in the show notes, you'll find a book by Christian Brose called The Kill Chain. I would urge all of you to read that. What Christian Brose suggests is that if we continue down this road of relying exclusively on exquisite platforms as the sine qua non, the raison d'etre of how the U.S. defense complex conducts what it does, we are going to find ourselves in the same place that Arthur C. Clarke described in his short story, Superiority. where you have two galactic empires at each other's throats who have been at war with each other for decades, and one defeats the other through brute simplicity, despite the exquisite and advanced technology of the others, who say, we can always find that wonder weapon that's going to cure all of our ills. That isn't going to happen. So if you go through my War Notes catalog, this happens to be episode 18, and I have whetted your appetite for a further inquiry into some of the things that I talked about. Maybe you'll find something among all of those episodes. But we are at a point now in the United States and the alliance complex when it comes to the military, where one is going to have to fish or cut bait and find a way for a sea change to occur in how the current 20th century exquisite military complex can contend. The United States can win in a 21st century peer conflict, because I don't think that it can. I'd love to hear from my listeners. If you have questions, comments, and gentlemanly riposte, you can get in touch with me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. If you happen to be listening to this on your favorite podcast vendor, please be so kind as to leave a salutary review via stars or narrative. I'd be much obliged. I have a Substack at which I post every one of my episodes, because I wanted to have a comments function where I could enjoin all of my brilliant listeners in conversation, and we can discuss this back and forth, and maybe even come up with some solutions to wicked problems. Who knows? There it is. Thanks for your solicitude. Thanks for listening. And this is Bill out.